2 Samuel chapter 13. 2 Samuel chapter 13. David has sinned. I always think this is kind of one of the reasons why you kind of know that the Bible is about real stuff, because it doesn't cover stuff up. It doesn't make the heroes look better than they are. They're just real guys. We know all about David's sin, his adultery with Bathsheba, looking out over his city one night, and he sees this woman bathing on the rooftop, and he sends his servants over and has them bring her to his place. Finds out that she's married to one of his good friends. She's the grandfather of one of his chief counselors. But that kind of doesn't mean much to him. He sleeps with her. He's king. And she gets pregnant. And to compound things, go from bad to worse, he tries to cover it up and eventually ends up killing her husband and marrying the woman. This is the man who is called the man after God's own heart. Now, if you've ever been betrayed by someone you loved, it probably hurts a little more than for others. This is a man who betrayed his vows, who betrayed a friend, and yet he's the man considered a man after God's own heart. Kind of doesn't make sense, does it? Because you kind of think, I kind of think, a man after God's own heart is the guy who does everything perfectly, crosses every T and dots every I. And you know, God wants us to walk in obedience, absolutely. But he is mindful, it says in Psalm 103, he is mindful of our frame, that we are but dust. He knows our weaknesses. David, after he was confronted with his sin by the prophet Nathan, confronts him over his sin after he's been trying to hide it. And David admits, he confesses, and God forgives his sin. There would be consequences to David's sin. Even though God forgives sin, there are going to be consequences sometimes on earth to our sins. You know, you go and you sleep with somebody who's got AIDS, and you confess your sin, God can forgive you, but you might still get AIDS. You know, that it's that kind of a thing. There will be earthly consequences to David's sin, and we're going to see some of them starting tonight. As we've mentioned before, David has many wives. At last count, he's up to about 8 wives at the same time. Another problem. This is not, I wish I could have been David. No, this is considered a problem. The Bible says that for kings not to multiply wives, that they will turn your heart away from the Lord. This is not a good thing. But you're going to see some of the outflow of this problem. He's got at least 8 wives now. He's got kids by most of them. And they're all living in the same, if not under the same roof, they're in the same town. And this is kind of like the ultimate blended family. There's lots of stepbrothers and stepsisters, or I should say half-brothers, actually. It's not stepbrothers. These are half-brothers and half-sisters. And you're going to see some of that mess coming into tonight's chapter. Chapter 13, verse 1. The chapter is about the rape of Tamar. After this, Absalom, the son of David, had a lovely sister whose name was Tamar. And Amnon, the son of David, loved her. We meet Absalom, the son of David. Absalom is the third son of David. He's, you know, from oldest to youngest, he's the third son. His mother's name was Maacah. She was the daughter of Talmai, the king of Geshur. That's because that's what kings do. They marry each other's sisters and brothers, and not brothers, their sisters and their daughters and all like this. It helps make for a nice political thing going on. It makes peace in the kingdom. You don't have to worry about Talmai invading Israel because my goodness, the king is married to his daughter. So Absalom, that makes Absalom the grandson of Talmai. That will come into play. We meet Amnon. Well, Absalom has a sister named Tamar. Now, Amnon, the son of David, this is the oldest son. He's the guy that you would call the crown prince. And I don't know if that means if he showed up in all the tabloids or what, you know, if the paparazzi are following him around or something like this. But Amnon is the first son. He's the one who's going to most logically be king next. His mother was a gal named Ahinoam of Jezreel. She's from up north. And it says that Amnon loved Tamar. The Greek word for love is ahab. The Greeks, which wrote, the New Testament was written in Greek. New Testament, the Greek language has lots of words for love. There's lots of different nuances and ways of telling different types of love apart. Not so in the Hebrew, not so in English. We use the word love for all kinds of things. We say, I love my wife. I do. I love my wife. I love my sons. I love Jamocha almond fudge ice cream. I do. I love Jamocha almond fudge ice cream. Now, the way I feel about Jamocha almond fudge is not quite the same the way I feel about my wife, if you know what I mean. I mean, the love for my wife is a whole lot different, right? In so many ways, it's so much different. But we use one word for all of it. Well, the Hebrews were the same thing. This could be human love, love in a family, sexual love, love for things like ice cream, love for God. It's used for God's love for man. It's just a general word. Amnon loved Tamar. We're going to find that it's not a very pure love. It's a pretty perverted love. Verse 2. So Amnon was so distressed over his sister Tamar that he became sick, for she was a virgin, and it was improper for Amnon to do anything to her. He becomes sick over this. I want to stop for a second and talk about confronting lust. We're going to see that for us, in our language, what Amnon is feeling towards Tamar is hardly love at all. Now, there's plenty of people who will call it love. We'd probably be better calling it lust. He has a huge lust, a lust for the wrong things, a strong desire for the wrong things. It's going to cause trouble. It's going to cause heartache. It is not right for Amnon to, it says, do anything to her for a couple of reasons. He just wants sex. That's what he wants. That's what he's going to get. And when he gets it, he'll be done, and he'll wipe his mouth and walk off and be done with her. He just wants a physical relationship with her. The Bible says that sex outside of marriage is a problem, and we call it sin. 1 Corinthians 6:18 says, flee sexual immorality. The word there is it's a broad word. We define it as simply sex outside of marriage. And so if I'm getting involved with anything outside of being married to the person, I'm crossing a line that God really doesn't want me to cross, because he doesn't think it's good for me. He thinks it's going to cause me trouble. Now, our world has gone way past this. Our world thinks, oh, you love somebody, you know, go move in together, you know. And the world says, well, if you really love them, what's wrong about it? Doesn't the world say that to us? If you really love them, well, gang, if you really love them, then get committed and get married to them. Do the right thing before you cross the sexual line. God's the one that invented sex. He knows how it works. Really good. In fact, it's part of what was really good in marriage. It came about in marriage before man sinned. It was a good thing, but he meant it to be in a place where you're committed to each other, a place where you're not just in and out and on to the next person. So he wants sex. That's part of why it's wrong, because that's what he wants. It's also wrong because he's her half-brother. That's kind of a little teeny bit of a problem, just a little teeny bit. They both have the same dad. Leviticus 18:9 says, "The nakedness of your sister, the daughter of your father, or the daughter of your mother." Isn't it funny? It doesn't just say your sister. He's very clear about this. It could be the daughter of your father or the daughter of your mother, because maybe those aren't the same, you know. It says, "Whether born at home or elsewhere, their nakedness you shall not uncover." That doesn't mean you just don't peek under their dress. It means you don't have sex with them. It's wrong. It's forbidden. So it says it was improper for him to do anything to her. Well, yeah. So what do you do when you have thoughts for things that are improper? What do you do with it? How do you handle it? Amnon is letting these thoughts stay in his mind. He's mulling it over day by day. He wakes up in the morning. Maybe he's drawn a little sketch of her on the wall or something, you know, or he gets up in the morning to watch her go out for breakfast, you know, and he watches her walk down the street, and he daydreams, and he thinks about her all the time, and he's making himself sick over it. James says this. Pay attention, gang. Pay attention. James says this. "But each one is tempted when he is drawn away by his own desires and enticed. Then when desire," and that's the word for lust, "when desire has conceived, it gives birth to sin. And sin, when it is full grown, brings forth death." The longer you let that stupid thought be okay in your head, the more you let it be, have a safe haven in your head, and you're going to just think about it. It's not wrong just to think about it. Well, there comes a time, even when you're thinking about it, where you start crossing a line. Jesus said, if you have lust for a woman, it's just like committing adultery with her, right? That's what Jesus said. He said, you just have the lust long enough, it's already crossing the line. Now, just having the first temptation, there's nothing wrong with that. But here's the deal, gang. Here's the deal. When you are wanting the wrong thing over and over and over again, you save yourself a world of heartache if you learn to nip it in the bud. If you learn to deal with it while it's just a thought. Do you recognize that the thing that you're thinking about is wrong? Do you recognize that? Now, most of us, we have a clue about that. Most of us are still sensitive enough to the Lord that we have a clue that the thing that I'm wanting is wrong, right? And you know what? You could all nod because we're all in this together. You are thinking I'm talking only about you tonight. I am not. Every single person in this room is exactly the same. How many of you are tempted to do bad things? Raise your hand, please. Everybody, get your hand up. Everybody, there you go. We are all tempted. The more you let it stay in your head, the more trouble you're giving yourself. I do this all the time. I know I am an expert at sinning. I know how to sin. Gang, is it wrong? Well, then you got to learn to nip it in the bud. I've had success in this, a little bit. I'm not an expert at it. I'm not batting 1,000 on this, okay? Don't think that every time Satan tosses a pitch at me, I hit it over the wall. I don't. But I'm getting better at recognizing it. And so what do? Think of something else. Change the channel. Get involved in something else. You have the ability to do that. You actually do. you can get up and move away from that thing. Cause yourself to look at something else. Read your Bible. Well, of course you could read your Bible. That would be a good thing. But it's not just about being religious, what some of you think. Just change your thoughts. Change your thoughts. Ask God to help you. Because beloved, if the more we learn to nip it in the bud, boy, you save yourself a world of heartache. You know, it's like you're driving down the street and you see that person walking on the street and they kind of look cute. Well, that's fine. So look somewhere else. You've noticed it. Now move your eyes away and look at something else. Change the channel. You see the stuff on the TV and it's a TV show that's going to go down a road that's not a healthy thing for your brain. Well, you could change the channel. You could. Nip it in the bud. Confront your lust. Learn to change your thinking. But that's not what Amnon's going to do. Watch what's going to happen. It's going to happen just like it happens in your life with your kind of sin that you struggle with. He thinks about it, and he thinks about it, and he thinks about it. He's getting sick over this now. He's been thinking about it. Verse 3. But Amnon had a friend whose name was Jonadab, the son of Shimeah, David's brother. Now, Jonadab was a very crafty man. Now, the word could be used to say he was smart, he was wise. I would call him sneaky. He's a sneaky fellow, this Jonadab. His name means Yahweh is willing. Now, even that's kind of sneaky, you know, because maybe he is not so willing, you know. But that's his name. His name is Yahweh is willing. He is David's nephew, which makes him Amnon's cousin. So when we read this, this is all in the family, gang. And you think your family was messed up. You know what? There's nothing new, gang. There is nothing new. I want to talk for just a second about the importance of friends. You know, in the end, you will stand before God and be judged based on what you do. You can't blame your friends. You can't say, well, yeah, but they made me. They told me that it was good and I should be doing that. Well, you can pull that off on all your other friends here on the earth, but you know what? It isn't going to fly with God, because God knows that you are big enough to just stand up and say no, right? You're big enough to stand up and say no. But friends will influence you, and they will either make it easier to say no to sin, or they're going to make it harder to say no to sin. And you know what? You have to make some choices over your friends. Jonadab is trouble. He's a smart cookie, but you know what? Smart isn't always right. He operates by this philosophy about expediency, not morality. You're feeling sick over this girl? Well, do something about it. You know, fulfill your desire. You know, who cares if it's wrong? It'll make you feel better. You know, I just care about you because you're my friend. And I just don't want you to feel so bad. So just, you know, smoke it. Do it. You know, whatever. You know, just go for it. Expediency, not morality. What kind of influence are your friends having on you? What kind of influence are your friends having on you? Do they encourage you to follow the Lord or to follow the flesh? Paul writes, "Do not be deceived. Bad company corrupts good morals." Now you got to be careful you don't go overboard on this. And we need balance in all things. It doesn't mean that you remove every non-Christian or carnal Christian friend from your life. Now, you might have to do that for a while. I mean, maybe that might be what you need to do. But gang, we're not supposed to leave the world. We are supposed to influence the world. And you have to be honest. You have to be real with it. Am I influencing my friends, or are they influencing me? If they're influencing me, maybe I got to step back a little bit. And I got to get my legs under me. And I got to get built up. I got to get strong, so that I can one day turn around and influence them. Because that's what God wants us to do. You don't go into it naively, think, well,
I'm going to win my girlfriend for Christ.
We call that evangelistic dating. That's what we used to call it in the old days. Evangelistic dating rarely works. Rarely works. Usually the other person will bring you down. That's just what it is. I mean, I can't answer for you. I can't tell you everything. But you got to be honest with yourself about the influence of your friends. Let's keep going. I'm only at three verses and I'm almost at it. I only got 45 minutes left. Oh my gosh. Verse 4. And he said to him, this is Jonadab, this is Yahweh is willing, Yahweh's willing. This is what he says to him. Why are you the king's son, the crown prince? Why are you becoming thinner day after day? Will you not tell me? Amnon said to him, I love Tamar, my brother Absalom's sister. So Jonadab said to him, ah, no problem. Lie down on your bed. Pretend to be ill. And when your father comes to see you, say, please let my sister Tamar come and give me food and prepare the food in my sight that I may see it and eat it from her hand. Let my sister Tamar come. You know, this is not good advice. Just got to tell you this right off the bat. Just going to, in case you're wondering, this is bad advice. I'm going to give you some good advice. The Japanese eat very little fat and suffer very few heart attacks compared to the British or the Americans. On the other hand, the French eat a lot of fat and also suffer fewer heart attacks than the British or Americans. The Japanese drink very little red wine and suffer fewer heart attacks than the British or Americans. The Italians drink excessive amounts of red wine and also suffer fewer heart attacks than the British or Americans. So, eat and drink what you like. It's speaking English that kills you. There you go.
Thank you, thank you, thank you very much, thank you very much.
Jonadab is giving some rotten advice. And my friends, that's what happens when your wrong friends are influencing you the wrong way. They may love you in their own way. They may think, I'm not saying that Jonadab's got horns and he's just out, I'm going to ruin Amnon. I think he probably likes his cousin. I think in his perverted way, he thinks he's doing the right thing. Your friends may think that they care about you. But be careful, gang. Verse 6. Then Amnon lay down and pretended to be ill. And when the king came to see him, Amnon said to the king, please let Tamar, my sister, come and make a couple of cakes for me in my sight that I may eat from her hand. And when he talks about cakes, think pancakes. That probably is closer to pancakes or tortillas. That's kind of what she's going to be cooking. And David sent home to Tamar, saying, now go to your brother Amnon's house and prepare food for him. So Tamar went to her brother Amnon's house, and he was lying down. Then she took flour, kneaded it, made cakes in his sight, and baked the cakes. She took the pan and placed them out before him, but he refused to eat. Then Amnon said, have everyone go out from me. And they all went out from him. Then Amnon said to Tamar, bring me the food into the bedroom that I may eat from your hand. And Tamar took the cakes which she had made and brought them to Amnon, her brother, in the bedroom. Now when she had brought them to him to eat, he took hold of her and said, come, lie with me, my sister. But she answered him, no, my brother, do not force me. For no such thing should be done in Israel. Do not do this disgraceful thing. Now, when she says no such thing should be done in Israel, she might be talking about the law of against brothers and sisters having sex. I think because of what she's going to talk about later, I think she's probably really thinking about the subject of premarital sex and rape, because she doesn't want to do this. And so this is going to be considered rape. He is disgraceful in that he's forcing her instead of being the gentleman and not forcing her. Verse 13. And she says, and I, where could I take my shame? And as for you, you would be like one of the fools in Israel. Now, therefore, please speak to the king, for he will not withhold me from you. When she says he will not withhold me from you, maybe it's possible that she's thinking dad's going to not worry about the law of the brothers and sisters, and he's going to let us get married or something. That could be what she's saying. It could be that she's just trying to talk him to slow down so she can get out of the room. It could be that as well. Verse 14, however, he would not heed her voice. Being stronger than she, he forced her and lay with her. He forced her. This is not real love. Ladies, I'm sure you are aware of this. I'm sure the ladies don't have to be told this. But if he wants to have sex with you and you don't, and he won't listen to you, it's not real love. It may be confused love. He may think that he loves you. But if you are wanting to wait and he isn't, there's a problem here. And gentlemen, if you ever use this line on a woman, if you love me, you will, don't you dare do that, because that is not real love. It is real lust. It is completely selfish, no matter what you tell yourself. You tell yourself, well, I just want to show her how much I love her. No, you want to have sex. That's, you know, call it what it is. But it's not real love. This is real love. 1 Corinthians 13, Paul says, love is patient and kind. Love is not jealous or boastful or proud or rude. Look at this next one. It does not demand its own way. It is not irritable. It keeps no record of being wronged. It does not rejoice about injustice, but rejoices whenever the truth wins out. Love never gives up, never loses faith, is always hopeful, and endures through every circumstance. Do you see some of those apply to this situation? Yeah, I could see a couple of them can apply to it, can't you? Patient, kind, doesn't demand its own way. That is love. That's what you shoot for. Guys, that's what you shoot for. That's what you're working at. Gals, that's what you're looking for. That's what you need to expect. The right kind of love is focused on what is right. The right kind of love is willing to wait. Now, verse 15. So he's raped her. Verse 15. Then Amnon hated her exceedingly, so that the hatred with which he hated her was greater than the love with which he had loved her. And Amnon said to her, arise, be gone. So she said to him, no, indeed, this evil of sending me away is worse than the other that you did to me. But he would not listen to her. Now, when she's sending me away, it's one thing to have sex and having raped me, but there is a law that it's possible that we could still work this out with dad and we could get married. But that's not his thing. His thing is, no, I'm done with you. Then he called his servant who attended him and said, here, put this woman out away from me and bolt the door behind her. He hated her. This is true lust. This is not true love. This is true lust. This is so typical of a relationship built on lust. It's all about getting what I want now, and when I get what I want, I'm done. Love waits until it is right. And I have to tell you that I've been married for a long time. I've been married for, 1978, June 10th. I think that makes it 34 years I've been married. And I got to tell you, a huge component in marriage is trust. My wife trusts me, and I trust her. We do. We trust each other. Not to say that I've never been jealous. I've had my moments. I've had my moments where I've been jealous about and worried and suspicious and, you know, and all this kind of stuff. But over and over, she proves to me that she is trustworthy. Think about this. I can trust you when we're married. I can trust you to say no to other temptations if I've seen you trustworthy to say no before we get married. Do you follow that? If I have learned and we have learned together that we will say no and wait until it's right, then we are demonstrating to each other that we know how to do the right thing. And we know how to say no to the wrong thing. And I have to tell you, it's not that you can never overcome that. Of course you can overcome that in a marriage. Of course. But I got to tell you, you are 10 steps ahead of the game when you enter a marriage learning to do the right thing. That doesn't guarantee a perfect marriage. Not at all, because there's like 300,000 other things you got to work on. But a key element of trust is showing that I can do the right thing. Okay, verse 18. Now she had a robe of many colors, for the king's virgin daughters wore such apparel. I think they went to the robe of many colors store. I don't know if that was J. Jill back then or Nordstrom's or what the store was, but they had these certain little things, and it just what the king's daughters who were virgins wore. And people saw them and they said, there's the king's daughter. Only the king's daughter wear these things. And then in fact, that's the king's daughter who is not married and she is a virgin. We know this because she proudly wears this, that she's a good girl and she's doing this. And so... It mentions this, and it says, and his servant put her out and bolted the door behind her. Then Tamar put ashes on her head. That's like a sign of mourning, of deep distress, and tore her robe of many colors that was on her. And laid her hand on her head and went away crying bitterly. She tore her robe. I find it interesting. I'm just fascinated. And she doesn't try to hide what's happened. But she openly displays that she has been raped, that she is no longer a virgin daughter of the king. There is a treasure, gang, in purity. Our society does not get it. Ha! Oh my gosh. If we were to talk about this out on the street, we would be laughed to kingdom come. Oh my gosh. Because the world's view right now is if you like the person, hey, go get a room, you know. That's the way the world, it's everywhere. It's even the good guys on the TV shows, you know, the best moral people, they, no problem. We moved in together, you know, all this kind of stuff. Our society does not get it. And yet this is how God designed us. To hold off on sex until we are in that relationship where we are committed and we ain't going anywhere. Where we're locked, we're handcuffed to each other, even by the law. That's what it's all about. Now, because of this, maintaining virginity until marriage is a huge blessing to a marriage. I've heard Dr. Dobson explain it this way, and I really like this analogy. That if a person's sexual nature, it's as if your sexual nature is worth $1 million. It's worth $1 million. And every time you have sex with another person, you're taking half of your treasure and sharing it with them. Now, when you're married to that person, that treasure stays in the family, doesn't it? Because she gives you your $500,000 and you give her $500,000 and we're good. Oh, it's good. But when you're not married to that person, you just lost half your fortune. And when you have sex with another person, it's now worth a quarter of what it was. And it goes on and on and on until it's not worth much at all. Virginity, purity, is a treasure. Maybe you've blown it. You know what? So stop blowing it. Stop blowing it. Stop now. Stop now. Stop blowing it and do the right thing. Save yourself for your marriage. I can see the new MasterCard commercial. Cost of the wedding chapel, $500. Cost of the bridal gown, $1,500. Cost of the reception, $10,000. That was a cheap one. Cost of purity and faithfulness, priceless. Absolutely. Absolutely. So she is all torn up over this. And Absalom, her brother, said to her, "Has Amnon, your brother, been with you? Has Amnon, your brother, been with you? But now hold your peace, my sister. He is your brother. Do not take this thing to heart." So Tamar remained desolate in her brother Absalom's house. She doesn't get married. And she's going to live with her brother the rest of her life. It sounds as if Absalom knows something about Amnon. And he knows about Amnon's request for her to come over. And he sees her ashes, her torn robe, and he puts two and two together. Verse 21, "But when King David heard of all these things, he was very angry. And Absalom spoke to his brother Amnon, neither good nor bad, for Absalom hated Amnon because he had forced his sister Tamar." It says David heard all these things. David, apparently the word got back, because word got out. She's no longer wearing the robe. Something has happened to Tamar. And so he hears about this. It's not hidden from him. And yet all he does is he gets mad. And I want to challenge you to think about what you do when trouble hits. This is an area of my life I'm working on because I kind of suck at it. And that's conflict resolution. What do you do when things go bad? Yeah, you're laughing at me because you know how bad you and we've talked about this. We've talked about this, friend. How do you deal with conflict? How do you deal with problems around you? Both David and Absalom do the same thing. They respond by not responding. David, he doesn't say anything. He just gets mad. And he doesn't do anything about it. Absalom, he doesn't talk to his brother about it. He just hates him. You ever been like that? You ever been like that where somebody's really hurt you? You'll see them because you have to see them. They're at work every day. You can't avoid them. But man, and you won't say anything because you're a nice guy. You have a reputation for being the nice guy. But you hate their guts. Well, that's the way these guys do this. I understand David's place. I understand his problem. Because frankly, there are plenty of times where I just don't know what to do. I don't know how to respond. How am I supposed to handle this? What am I supposed to do with this person? And sometimes it's better not to respond than to respond in the wrong way. I have to admit that. I've learned that the hard way. It could be that David can't stand to think of what he's supposed to be doing. As the king, he's the one who enforces, he's the one in charge of enforcing the law. In Leviticus 20, this is what the law is. If a man takes his sister, his father's daughter or his mother's daughter, and sees her nakedness and she sees his nakedness, it is a wicked thing. They shall be cut off in the sight of their people. He has uncovered his sister's nakedness. He shall bear his guilt. So the penalty for brother and sister sleeping together, it says it would be cut off. Now, what does that mean? It might mean that you're kicked out of town. It could mean that you're put to death. Either of which, I would imagine David wasn't thrilled about, no matter what. So I'm sure he's thinking, well, what am I supposed to do? Oh, my gosh, what am I supposed to do? Amnon, he's my oldest son. He's guy's supposed to be king, for Pete's sake. What am I supposed to do? Am I supposed to kick my son out of town? Am I supposed to put him to death? And, you know, to make things worse, all David has to do is think back to his own life. Because he's the one that set the example. He's the one that screwed up royally. He's a royal screw-up. That's because he's the king. So he, whatever he does is royal. He's a royal screw-up. And he asked for forgiveness, and God gave it. So what does he do? How does he respond? The problem with David's inaction is that it's going to bring about a simmering bitterness in Absalom that will result in the murder of Amnon. So, chapter 13, verse 23, and it came to pass after 2 full years that Absalom had sheep shearers in Baal Hatzor, which is near Ephraim. So Absalom invited all the king's sons. Now, so we now move up in time 2 years. And we will see what will happen when you hold a grudge for a long time. You know, I got to tell you, sometimes when you're mad at somebody and you got a conflict with somebody, I have learned that sometimes it's okay to cool off a little bit. Sometimes I get so heated. Oh my gosh, you don't want to see me angry. I'm so glad. I don't think any of you see me angry. I'm so glad. God bless you. Now my son in the back, he's seeing me angry. He knows. It's not a pretty sight when I get angry. And so I get it. Sometimes you got to cool down a little bit before you try to resolve it. Sometimes things are just, it's just easier to resolve it if you let things cool off. But if you wait too long, bitterness grows. That's why Paul says, be angry and do not sin. Do not let the sun go down on your wrath, nor give place to the devil. And the point is, resolve things. I have to tell you, I do know people who have taken this so literally that when they have an argument with their wife at 6 p.m. at dinner time, that they will argue and argue in order to resolve this and stay up. I've heard of people staying up all night arguing to resolve this because they don't want to let the sun go down on their wrath. You know what I'd say? I'd say, grow up. Oh my gosh. Oh my gosh. There is a place for pulling back. I don't know that you have to take this so literally that you have to resolve it before the sun goes down. But it does mean get it fixed. Don't let the bitterness build up. Time goes by and recollections change. Have you ever compared notes with somebody over some difficult circumstance 3 years later? And have you ever noticed how you don't remember it that way? I remember it this way, and you remember it this way. But you're wrong, because I remember it this way. Well, you know what? That's just what our brains do to us. We have selective memory. We choose to ignore certain things. And we interpret things so much to the point where we think, well, my interpretation is exactly the way it happened. Because I know that you were a sneaking, conniving thief, and that's, you planned it all along. I know, because I've told myself that 300 times, you know. That's why it's better to resolve things quicker while you really actually remember them a little closer to the way they are. I know of situations where people have let things go for 20 years and there's no way. It will be a miracle to see them resolved, because they have built up their ideas so strongly of how things are. It's a shame. Oh my gosh. Now, it mentions sheep shearers in Baal Hatzor. Absalom has sheep shears. The time of shearing sheep was... Now, that's an interesting looking thing. What is that? Huh. Anyway, it's supposed to be party time, because when you shear your sheep, it's party time. We're going to make some money, and we have parties, and we have break out the food. And so this is going to be a festive occasion when Absalom is shearing his sheep. So he's going to invite everybody over for the party. Baal Hatzor, there's Jerusalem. Baal Hatzor is about, where is it? It's 10 miles or so to the north of Jerusalem. 15 miles to the north of Jerusalem. It's a good one day's journey from home. So he's going to conveniently have this party a little bit away from dad and everything. And it's going to be far enough away that nobody can interfere with this thing. It says, verse 24, then Absalom came to the king and said, kindly note, your servant has sheep shearers. Please let the king and his servants go with your servant. Pops, why don't you bring a whole family? And we'll have us a big old party. You love sheep shearing because his dad's a shepherd. He knows what that's all about. And the king said to Absalom, no, my son, let us not all go now, lest we be a burden to you. You know, son, I'm used to picking up the checks. It's too big of a check for you to pick up. We don't have to do this. Then he urged him, but he would not go, and he blessed him. You know, God bless you, son. I'm just so tickled that you thought about inviting your old dad, you know, and kind of sounds innocent and generous. And David declines. I kind of wonder, as you watch this unfold, if Absalom is probably expecting dad to decline. I don't think he wants his dad here when he's going to do what he's going to do. Then Absalom said, well, if you can't go, how about my big brother Amnon go with us? And the king said to him, why should he go with you? Now, I know I'm reading it kind of sneaky, you know. Why should he go with you? But I kind of wonder if David suspects something. Why does he make a point of mentioning Amnon by name? But Absalom urged him, so he let Amnon and all the king's sons go with him. Now, Absalom had commanded his servants, saying, watch now when Amnon's heart is merry with wine. Wait till he's drunk. And when I say to you, strike Amnon, then kill him. Do not be afraid. Have I not commanded you? Be courageous and valiant. So they want to do a dirty deed. They're going to wait till he's drunk so he can't fight back. And he's telling his servants, this is all on me. I'm the one that's behind this. So, verse 29. The servants of Absalom did to Amnon as Absalom had commanded. So they killed him. They killed Amnon. Then all the king's sons arose, and each one got on his mule and fled. They all got in their cars and lit out for home. So a panda walks into a diner, sits down, and orders a sandwich. He eats the sandwich, pulls out a gun, and shoots out the restaurant's windows. As the panda stands up to go, the owner shouts, hey, where are you going? You just shot out my windows. You didn't even pay for your sandwich. The panda yells back at the owner, hey, man, I'm a panda. Look it up. The owner opens his dictionary and sees the following definition of panda. Panda, a tree-dwelling marsupial of Asian origin characterized by distinct black and white coloring, eats, shoots, and leaves. Had nothing to do with this, unless you think that maybe Absalom's acting a little bit like a panda. How's that? Is that a good tie-in for a bad joke? That's a good excuse for a bad joke. What do you think? Eats, shoots, and leaves. Okay, move on. Verse 30. And it came to pass, while they were on the way, that news came to David, saying, Absalom has killed all the king's sons, and not one of them is left. Okay, let's see a show of hands. Have you been reading with me? That's not the test. Okay. True or false? Absalom has killed all the king's sons. How many of you think that's true? Good. How many of you think that's false? Correct. You are correct. This is wrong information. Gang, when you hear news, it isn't always correct. It is not always fair or balanced. You know this, don't you? Whenever the big news event happens, you never trust what you hear in the first hour or two, do you? Oh, my gosh, they tell you all sorts of things. I remember in 9/11. I remember hearing, well, a little Cessna plane flew into the Twin Towers. It was not a little Cessna plane. Oh, my gosh, not even close. Sometimes people don't know the whole truth. Some people even lie about what happens. Proverbs 18:13 says, he who answers a matter before he hears it, it is folly and a shame to him. Why am I saying this? Because when you hear certain news and you respond to it, make sure that you check your facts. Make sure that you really know that it's really, really happening. Because David's going to be all stressed out for a while until he finds out the truth. For no good reason. Because somebody just didn't know what was happening. What would you do if you heard Pastor Rich was arrested last week for drunk driving? What would you think? Huh? Who's Pastor Rich? I don't know. You know what? There's something inside of us that loves to hear bad news like that. Isn't there? There's something inside of us. We go, wow. He got arrested for drunk driving last week? And he's up front teaching us tonight? There's even something inside of us that wants to be the first one to tell everybody the awesome, horrible news. And it's not even true. I think it's because you feel important. I know I do. If I, you know, I've heard some amazing thing, you know, like, you know, when the Angels signed Albert Pujols, I was telling everybody because I want to be the guy to tell everybody we got Albert Pujols. My goodness. Oh, wow. And everybody thinks you're awesome because you're the first to know. You know what? Careful there. Sometimes we're dealing with wrong information. Slow down, catch your breath, find out if it's true. Verse 31. So the king arose, tore his garments, and lay on the ground because he thinks all of his sons are dead. And all his servants stood by with their clothes torn. Then Jonadab, the son of Shimeah, that's that sneaky guy, David's brother answered and said, let not my lord suppose they have killed all the young men, the king's sons, for only Amnon is dead. For by the command of Absalom, this has been determined from the day that he forced or raped his sister Tamar. Now, therefore, let not my lord the king take the thing to heart to think that all the king's sons are dead, for only Amnon is dead. What's up with this Jonadab guy? Oh, my gosh, he's like the evil character, you know, the sneaky, this bad news guy. You've known this all along, and you didn't say anything? Oh, my gosh. Oh, my gosh. Then Absalom fled, and the young man who was keeping watch, the guy that's guarding the city back at home in Jerusalem, lifted his eyes and looked, and there many people were coming from the road on the hillside behind him. And Jonadab said to the king, look, the king's sons are coming. As your servant said, so it is. So it was, as soon as he had finished speaking, that the king's sons indeed came, and they lifted up their voice and wept. Also the king and all his servants wept very bitterly, because Amnon was dead. But Absalom fled and went to Talmai, the king of Amichud, king of Geshur, and David mourned for his son every day. So Absalom fled, went to Geshur, and was there for 3 years. He went to Geshur. Geshur is up to the north. It's right overlooking the Sea of Galilee. It's about 70, 80 miles north of Jerusalem. And we actually, they've kind of a cool thing they discovered about 10, 15 years ago. Geshur, that's ancient Geshur, and it overlooks, it's, you know, like half a mile from the lake now. It was a little bit closer back in those days, but there was a canal that would take boats out to the lake. Geshur in Jesus' day was ancient Bethsaida, built on top of ancient Geshur. So it's kind of fascinating. That's Peter's hometown, lots of cool stuff there. I won't take time to talk about this. Talmai is who? It's Grandpa. That's why he's going there. He's going to Grandpa's house. Because that's about the only place that'll probably be safe. Grandpa will save me, will protect me. And King David longed to go to Absalom, for he had been comforted concerning Amnon because he was dead. So eventually David gets over Amnon's death. He regrets not having both of these sons. Quick word before we jump into the next chapter, and I think I can do the next chapter in 10 minutes, actually. Sowing and reaping, we're seeing the consequences begin to unfold of David's sin with Bathsheba. David committed adultery. Amnon rapes. David murdered Uriah. Absalom kills his brother. Is this a coincidence? Is it a coincidence you have a sexual sin and a murder? Of course not. They're just doing what Dad did. They're just doing what Dad did. Why does Amnon rape his sister? Well, because I'm the crown prince. I can get anything I want. That's probably the same thing that went through David's head. I'm the king. I can do whatever I want. Careful, careful, gang. We reap what we sow. And the hard thing is sometimes the people around us pick up on it and learn from us. Chapter 14. So Joab, the son of Zeruiah, perceived that the king's heart was concerned about Absalom, because he's starting to miss Absalom. David's been talking about Absalom. Joab is David's nephew. He's the head of the army. He also happens to be a murderer himself, killing Abner in revenge for his brother's death. Joab is also Absalom's cousin. And Joab seems to want to help David. He sees that David's miserable, and he thinks he's got a solution. And Joab sent to Tekoa and brought from there a wise woman and said to her, "Please pretend to be a mourner and put on mourning apparel. Do not anoint yourself with oil, but act like a woman who has been mourning a long time for the dead." Now, Tekoa is to the south of Jerusalem, so it's about 10 miles to the south. That's where he's going to pull this woman from, is from Tekoa. Where's Tekoa? There's Tekoa. Verse 3. And he says to her, "Go to the king, speak to him in this manner." So Joab put words in her mouth. Now, remember, David's like the Supreme Court. He's like the final judge in Israel. And when people need help, you go to the king. You file a lawsuit and go to the king. You present your case before the king. And some people have been known to misuse that and to trip David up in his own words. Remember Nathan telling the story about the rich guy and the lamb? And then David goes, "Kill the guy, make him pay back." And Nathan points his finger and says, "You're the man." Remember how he kind of used this whole thing? Well, Joab thinks it works once. Let's try it again. So he's got this story. He's got this gal that's going to tell him a story. And when the woman of Tekoa spoke to the king, she fell on her face to the ground and prostrated herself and said, "Help, O king." Now, she's just saying what Joab has coached her to say. Then the king said to her, "What troubles you?" And she, because he thinks this is a real deal. This is something, the woman needs help. And she answered, "Indeed, I am a widow. My husband is dead. Now your maidservant," that's me, she says, "had two sons, and the two fought with each other out in the field, and there was no one to part them, and the one struck the other and killed him. You've told your kids, stop fighting or you'll kill your brother." Well, this actually happened. Killed his brother. This is the story that she's telling. Whether it's true or not, we don't know. "And now," she says, "the whole family has risen up against me, your maidservant, and they said, deliver him who struck his brother, that we may execute him for the life of his brother whom he killed, and we will destroy the heir also, so they would extinguish my ember that is left and leave to my husband neither name nor remnant in the earth." Remember, she's a widow, no other kids, only one son left. He's the last remaining heir of the name of the land of our father, and now they want to take him and kill him because he's a murderer. And the king said to the woman, "Go to your house, and I will give orders concerning you." "Hey, give me some time, woman, and go away, bother me, girl. You know, get away, and I'll tell you later. I'll send you an email when I get this answer, you know." And the woman of Tekoa said to the king, my lord, O king, let the iniquity be on me and on my father's house, and the king and his throne be guiltless." In other words, if you make a bad decision, it's okay. I'll own this whole thing. So the king said, whoever says anything to you, bring him to me, and he shall not touch you anymore. You got a troublemaker in your family, just tell him to talk to the king. Then she said, please let the king remember the Lord your God, and do not permit the avenger of blood to destroy any more, lest they destroy my son. And he said, as the Lord lives, not one hair of your son shall fall to the ground. Now, the avenger of blood, it's not talking about those avengers. He's talking about what we would call ancient blood feuds, kind of like the Hatfields and the McCoys. You hurt somebody in my family, I am honor bound to go hurt you. You kill somebody in my family, even if it's an accident, I got to go kill somebody in your family. That's kind of the way it works. And so there will be somebody in her family, supposedly, that's out to kill this last remaining son. And David says, it's okay, I've decided not one hair will fall on his head. I've given this kid complete, full pardon. Verse 12. Therefore the woman said, please let your maidservant speak another word to my lord the king. And he said, say on. And the woman said, why then have you schemed? This is a woman talking to the king. Why then have you schemed such a thing against the people of God? For the king speaks this thing as one who is guilty, in that the king does not bring his banished one home again. For we will surely die and become like water spilled on the ground, which cannot be gathered up again. Yet God does not take away a life, but he devises means so that his banished ones are not expelled from him. So she's trying to say, well, look, king, this is really all about you. It's not about saving my one alive son. It's about saving your alive son, Absalom. Bring him back. It says that we're like water spilled in the ground. The idea is that we're all going to die. And you pour out water in the ground and it's gone, isn't it? It's gone. There is a principle there. She's a wise woman of Tekoa. And this goes back to that resolve thing, resolving conflicts. Because, gang, one day they're going to be gone. And don't let your pride stand in the way from making things right. When people are dead and gone, like water spilled on the ground, you will regret not having taken the effort to try to reconcile. You may not be able to do it, because some people are just stubborn and they just won't do it. But you've at least got to make the try, because one day it will be too late. And I have to tell you, as a pastor who talks to people and counsels people, you don't want to go down that road where they've died on you and you never got to make things right, because you never took the step. Take the step. Make things right. Verse 15. Now, therefore, I have come to speak this thing to my lord the king, because the people have made me afraid. Somebody twisted my arm. And your maidservant said, I will now speak to the king. It may be that the king will perform the request of his maidservant, for the king will hear and deliver his maidservant from the hand of the man who would destroy me and my son together from the inheritance of God. Your maidservant said, the word of my lord the king will now be comforting, for as the angel of God, she's flattering him now, as the angel of God, so is my lord the king in discerning good and evil. You always do the right thing. Oh, kingy, you're the best. And may the Lord your God be with you. Then the king answered and said to the woman, please do not hide anything from me that I ask you. And the woman said, okay, go ahead and speak. And the king said, is Joab behind this? Sounds like Joab. And the woman answered and said, as you live, my lord the king, no one can turn to the right hand or the left from anything that my lord the king has spoken, for your servant Joab commanded me, and he put all these words in my mouth. He told me everything. Say, here's the script, you know. To bring about this change of affairs, your servant Joab has done this thing. But my lord is wise according to the wisdom of the angel of God for everything that's on the earth. And the king said to Joab, so now he turns to the guy who's really, he's really dealing with. Because he doesn't need to talk to this woman. He needs to talk to Joab. And he turns to Joab and says, all right, I have granted this thing. Go bring back the young man, Absalom. So Joab fell to the ground on his face, bowed himself, and thanked the king. And Joab said, today your servant knows that I have found favor in your sight, O my lord the king, and that the king has fulfilled the request of his servant. So Joab arose, went to Geshur, and brought Absalom to Jerusalem. And the king said, let him return to his own house, but do not let him see my face. So Absalom returned to his own house, but did not see the king's face. Apparently, David's okay with letting him come back, and he will not put him to death. But he must not be convinced that it's completely right to restore him. He's still not quite sure. Maybe he's not sure whether he should have put him to death or whatever. But he can come back. He just can't see David. So verses 25 to 33, let me just tell you that it talks about Absalom. Absalom is back. I'm back. He came back. He's good looking. He's handsome. He's got the most beautiful locks. Verse 26, it says that once a year he cuts his hair, and the weight of his hair is 200 shekels, which means he's got 5 pounds of hair that grows on him every day. He's kind of like a cross between Fabio and the beard, Brian Wilson. You know, this is just, he's like manly man, and he's handsome, he's good looking. Everybody loves this guy. He's got kids, 3 sons, a daughter named Tamar, by the way. Interesting, who is beautiful. He lives in Jerusalem for 2 years, and he never sees the king. And so Absalom, verse 29, sends for Joab because he wants to find out, why can't I go see dad? And he sends notes, he sends messengers, and Joab never returns his emails. He never answers his phone. He never returns his calls. And you have to kind of speak up someday. And so Absalom comes up with this kooky idea. He tells his servants, because he lives next door to Joab. They have fields next door to each other. And he tells his servants to go set Joab's fields on fire. And so he does. They go out and he burns down Joab's fields. And Joab's a little bit burned up when he visits Absalom. And Absalom says, why didn't you return my phone calls? You know, this is silly, you know. And I want to see dad. It would have been better if I'd stayed with grandpa than if I moved all the way back here and have been treated like this. So Joab goes and talks to David. David gives in, verse 33. And when he had called for Absalom, he came to the king, bowed himself on his face to the ground before the king, and the king kissed Absalom. David is restored. Absalom is restored to David, and it all looks good until we turn the page. But that's next time. So let's stand and let's pray.